Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. In the early morning on April 26, 1986, reactor number 4 of the Chernobyl Atomic Energy Station exploded during a technical test, triggering one of the 20th century's greatest disasters. More than 400 times more radiation was emitted than that released by the atomic bomb dropped on Hiroshima in 1945. The Chernobyl explosion killed 31 people. Today's guest, journalist Adam Higginbotham, spent 10 years investigating how propaganda, secrecy, and myth have obscured the true story of the disaster. Adam Higginbotham is a journalist whose narrative nonfiction and feature writing has appeared in a number of publications, including The New Yorker and The New York Times. He is the author of the new book, Midnight in Chernobyl, The Untold Story of the World's Greatest Nuclear Disaster. Hi, Adam. Welcome to the show, and congratulations on your new book.
Oh, thank you, and thank you for having me.
Well, thank you so much. In your acknowledgments, you write that the origins of this project go back many years, with roots in the story that you first followed in the news as a teenager and returned to decades later as a magazine writer. Why did you decide to take on such a major project?
Well, my initial interest in it was a little bit more closely confined than is covered in the book. Because I began work on a magazine story in 2005, just ahead of the 20th anniversary of the accident. And at that point, what I was interested in doing was taking the same sort of approach that Walter Lord took to the Titanic disaster in his book, A Night to Remember, and simply to reconstruct the events through eyewitness testimony and documents of the night of the accident itself. And that was just that was going to be a one-off magazine story of, you know, sort of 6,000 words. But what happened is that when I first began interviewing eyewitnesses to what happened, who were there at the time and were in the reactor building at the point of the explosion, you know, I began realizing that there was just much more to this story than I had understood, even in the background reading I'd done before I went to meet them. And more importantly, I realized that my own conceptions of what had happened and the people involved, you know, had been affected by propaganda about the Soviet Union that I had absorbed as a teenager. So, you know, I initially approached these people thinking that they were all going to be these sort of drab victims of the socialist experiment. But when I started talking to them about their lives before the accident, you know, I realized that they'd been not that much older than me at the time, and that they'd had sort of hopes and aspirations and expectations of the future that were not dissimilar to my own. So what I wanted to do, and what drew me into the book project, was to try and, you know, bring these people to life as real human beings and not simply names on a page.
Hmm. Well, that part's really interesting. You met some of these people when you went to Moscow 13 years ago?
Yeah. In fact, the first two people I interviewed for the magazine story were Alexander Yevchenko and his wife Natalia, and they ended up becoming, you know, principal protagonists in the book.
So the other part that's so fascinating about all of this is the misinformation that you say resulted from a lack of information. For example, a lot of people still think that tens of thousands of people died almost immediately, but that is not the case. And you say that one of the reasons why is because Western correspondents in Moscow were not allowed access to information, and so they basically did their best with rumors and hearsay. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, so what happened is that, you know, the Soviet government initially tried to cover the whole thing up as best they could. And then when, you know, inevitably, because the release of radiation was so enormous and this toxic cloud began spreading across Western Europe, you know, they couldn't keep it secret any longer. Then they attempted to prevent any detailed information or reporting by Western correspondents. And the way that it worked was the Western correspondents were all sequestered in Moscow and required official government permission to travel, you know, beyond the city limits. So, of course, what they did is, you know, they didn't give permission for anybody to leave Moscow. So these foreign correspondents who were based there, you know, tried working whatever contacts they had to report on what that, you know, what that week was the biggest story in the world. And as a result, you know, the initial reporting was quite inaccurate. So the thing that you're referring to is that the New York Post reported 4 or 5 days after the accident that 15,000 people were reportedly killed as a result of the explosion, and that their bodies had been buried as nuclear waste in a giant pit somewhere in Ukraine. And, you know, and those kind of stories are the things that affected people's perceptions of the accident right at the instant it happened and soon afterwards. And I think those, you know, those still resonate today.
When the New York Post reported that 15,000 people had died, you report that the death toll at that point was 2.
That's right. There was one person who was killed in the initial explosion, and another plant operator died around dawn that day as a result of burns he sustained in the accident. And, you know, subsequent deaths didn't take place until several weeks later.
Adam, your book is a massive undertaking. Even in your section on cast of characters, you've got management, staff, firefighters, the government, the nuclear experts, the generals, the doctors, just a number of characters in your book. And the reporting is this is a huge undertaking. I mean, without the notes, and gosh, the notes are huge, it's about just over 370 pages, but your notes just go on and on. Heavily researched, really incredible book. Can you talk about, since you spent 10 years investigating this, I mean, how did you go about getting all of this information? And, I mean, you have a lot of new information in addition to the interviews. You went through a number of documents. Just give us a sense of how you went about taking on this project.
Well, I wouldn't want to give you the impression that I spent 10 years doing nothing else, because I think I'd have ended up in a straitjacket if that was the case. But, I mean, what happened really is that because I began reporting it as a story so long ago, back in 2006... you know, that made it a lot easier for me to approach what, you know, as you say, was a huge project, because it meant for a long time I was able to build up a sense of what the overall arc of the story was, because I did one piece that was about the reconstruction of the night of the accident back in 2006, and then I returned to the exclusion zone again in the beginning of 2011 to do a story about a different aspect of the accident, about the long-term ecological consequences and these ideas that... you know, the exclusion zone that was established around the reactor in 1986 has since become the sort of radioactive safari park in which wildlife is thriving, and to a certain extent debunking that idea. But that meant that when I came to work full-time on the book in 2015, I had a sense of what the story was, and then I had to go out and fill in the gaps in my own reporting and in what had been reported, certainly in English, up to that point. So I was able to kind of build on work that I'd been doing for years in order to go and find the people who could help fill in those gaps, find the people who were, you know, in the rooms, in the meetings at the time, or who were in the specific parts of the plant when the explosion took place, or who could explain to me what it was like in the hospital that the most severely injured victims were sent to in the immediate aftermath of the explosion.
And when you started doing your research, did you have a line of questioning? I mean, was there one or two main questions that you hoped would be answered?
I'm not sure that I had one main question in mind. You know, what I wanted to do was really to construct the story in a certain way. So rather than a certain question, there was a kind of material and a form of the narrative and the story that I wanted to be able to reconstruct. I wanted to write an accurate history of what had happened, because I over the years of my reporting, I became aware that a lot of what people understand and a lot of what had been published in books in English previously were based in sort of folk tales and mythology and the sort of game of telephone of ideas that were aired in the immediate period after the explosion took place and in the months afterwards that had gradually just been repeated and repeated without anybody going back and checking them. So I wanted to get those details right, but at the same time I also wanted to bring the experience these people had lived through alive so that the readers could understand what it was really like to live in the Soviet Union and also to live through the accident. And on top of that, I wanted to make sure that it was... it was an engaging narrative. I wanted to construct it and have it let it have the tone of a thriller. So those were the sort of guiding principles behind what I was trying to do.
Today we're speaking with journalist Adam Higginbotham about his new book, Midnight in Chernobyl, The Untold Story of the World's Greatest Nuclear Disaster. And if you have any questions for Adam or you'd like to talk about what you remember about how this was reported, we'd love to hear from you, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Let's talk about why this happened in the first place. In your book, you go through in very great detail how the plant was built and who worked there. You provide graphic details of what it looked like. And you write about how there was a lack of readiness to actually finish the project. So first off, what really struck you about just what the plant looked like?
It looked like in what sense? You mean inside the power plant itself?
Yes. Like what really struck you when you first visited and when you talked to people about it, people who worked there?
Oh, it's a really bewildering place because it's like being inside some sort of giant submarine or something. You travel for, you know, hundreds of meters in every direction through these kind of windowless corridors that are lined with pipework, and it becomes immediately apparent that unless you really know what you're doing, you can just become lost within a minute and a half because it's this kind of warren of barely lit, dimly lit rooms, and you know, as I say, lots of plumbing everywhere, and these sort of, you know, clanging steel staircases that lead who knows where.
So, what would you say was the key design fault that led to this disaster?
That's quite difficult to say because there are an awful lot of design faults. The principal failing was that the designers of the reactor knew that there were many things wrong with it, that they had established more than 10 years before the accident took place. But they either slow-walked fixes on them or they just tried to cover up the problems completely, with the result that, you know, by the time the accident happened, there was this whole litany of things that was wrong with the reactor, from the fact that the plumbing was defective and the emergency control rods that were used to shut down the reactor in the case of a crisis were deliberately designed to move slowly, to the fact that there were certain periods of operation where the instrumentation of the reactor itself was so rudimentary that the operators were simply expected to guess and judge by intuition what was happening inside it because the instrumentation couldn't tell them. Mm. But I think, you know, the most significant fault in direct connection with the disaster that happened in 86 was the design of these control rods, which were, in the most simplistic way, they're designed to control the amount of reactivity in the reactor. As you insert them, the amount of reactivity and the amount of power in the reactor is reduced. And if you withdraw them, then it increases. Now, at the point when the reactor was shut down, you would press a button and all of these rods would enter the reactor core, and they were designed to shut it down. But there was a design fault in the tips of these reactor control rods that meant that for a brief split second when they first entered the core, reactor power could actually increase rather than decrease. So it was as if you stamped on the brakes of your car and instead of slowing down, your car suddenly accelerated and jumped forward. And it was this sort of inversion of the safety system that was the immediate and proximate cause of the explosion that destroyed the reactor. Mm.
You know, one of the most incredible parts of the book, the shocking parts of your book, was learning about the people who were involved in the cleanup and learning about how they were exposed to the radiation. The firefighters, the people who were in the plant, those who came for the cleanup. What happened to the people who were there when the explosion actually happened?
Well, that's an interesting question, because one of the things that prompted me to realize that there was, you know, there was a kind of amazing story to be written about this accident in the first place, was that when I started meeting people in 2006, you know, there were a lot of people I simply couldn't believe were still alive, because the things they were describing they'd witnessed, you know, as far as I could see with my conception of the way radiation worked, you know, should have killed them long previously. But a surprising number of people who were in the building when it exploded, you know, have lived for a long time afterwards and continue to live to this day. And some of them even still work in the nuclear industry in Ukraine.
The other thing is, I'm sure a lot of people remember this. I mean, like you, I was a teenager when this happened. But within 24 hours, the invisible cloud of radiation reached Scandinavia. And at midday on Sunday, an automatic monitoring device at the, is it RISO National Lab, north of...
I think that is right. I don't think I've ever said that word out loud. So your guess is as good as mine. RISO.
RISO, okay. And then I'll guess again, Roskilde, north of Roskilde, silently logged the cloud's arrival in Denmark. But because it was on a Sunday, the readings went unnoticed. The same thing happened in Sweden. Can you remind us of just how this invisible cloud of radiation moved and where it moved to? And what do we now know about it?
Well, what happened is that as soon as the explosion happened, because the lid of the reactor was torn away, and then the roof of the building over the reactor was utterly destroyed, this huge cloud of radionuclides and toxic vapor escaped into the atmosphere above the plant, and then it rose to a point 1,500 meters in the air, where it was snatched away by these high altitude winds, which immediately began sweeping it north. So, as you describe, it quickly ended up in Scandinavia. But at that point, the Soviet government was still denying that anything had happened at all. You know, there was no announcement. There was the local people were evacuated in total secrecy. But the Soviet government and the Soviet news agency TASS made no announcement about any kind of accident on Saturday or on Sunday. So what happened is that this power plant in Forsmark in Sweden, there was a plant worker there who worked in the radiochemistry lab, who first thing in the morning around 8 o'clock went through the radiation detection equipment at the front door of the plant and discovered that he was setting off the radiation alarm. And he couldn't work out why, because he hadn't been inside the reactor building itself. So he thought to himself that there was no way that he could possibly be contaminated. And a chain of events began in which more and more workers arriving at work began discovering to their bewilderment that they were setting off these alarms. And it was hours before they figured out that the reason this was happening was not because of a leak from within their own plant, but because the workers were walking through the parking lot on the way to work. And it had rained overnight, and the rain had brought down fallout that had been swept in from Chernobyl.
Wow.
And that is how Western governments finally discovered what had happened.
Well, and to add to the story you're telling us about how the accident was immediately buried, as you said, the Soviets told the Swedes that nothing happened, and it took 3 days for the Soviets to announce on the radio, quote, an accident has taken place at the Chernobyl nuclear power plant. One of the atomic reactors has been damaged. Measures are being taken to eliminate the consequences of the accident. Aid is being given to those affected. A government commission has been set up, end quote. Can you tell us more about that and what the reaction was?
Well, they issued that statement late in the evening of Monday, and the explosion took place, as you say, in the early hours of Saturday morning. And by that time, the Swedes and other Western governments had made repeated inquiries in Moscow to try and find out whether or not they would admit to there having been a nuclear accident within the borders of the Soviet Union, which the Soviet authorities continued to deny. But that morning, Mikhail Gorbachev, the General Secretary of the Soviet Union, had called what he regarded as an emergency Politburo meeting, even though he'd obviously waited more than 2 days to do that. And they in that meeting, they deliberated about what they were going to tell the Soviet people and to tell the rest of the world. And at that point, this was a kind of key test of glasnost, this policy of open government that Gorbachev had aired at the Communist Party, the main Communist Party meeting earlier in that year. And subsequently, Gorbachev has insisted that, you know, it was his intention to be completely open about what had happened right from the outset. But that is certainly not what happened. And the statement that they issued was one which reflected the what they regarded as the traditional way of approaching these things, where they just said as little as possible and tried to minimize the damage in terms of the public reputation of the Soviet Union. So the statement that you read, of course, makes no mention of radiation or radioactive releases at all. and they continued to try and minimize information about what had really happened, and even the time scale of when it had happened, because the statement didn't even say when the explosion had taken place, for as long as they could.
And then Radio Moscow's World Service repeated the announcement in English for foreign listeners and followed it by cataloging the long record of nuclear accidents in the West.
Exactly. And, you know, almost immediately they tried to paint themselves in a better light by suggesting that this was just the same as all the accidents that had been logged at, you know, Three Mile Island and Windscale in Britain, and all the other accidents that had been reported in the Western press. And it was only, you know, when it became apparent that, that the accident was taking on a scale and potential consequences that there was no way they could conceal, that they began to be slightly more open about what had happened. And at that point, they showed pictures and eventually television footage on the evening news. But that was partly to allay these Western stories, like the one of 15,000 people having been killed immediately. So their policy really sort of backfired from the outset, because instead of minimizing what was happening, you know, it gave rise to these rumors and misinformation that actually exaggerated initially the scale of what had happened.
When you looked into why they wanted to keep this a secret, I mean, such a massive explosion, it's obviously, we know why initially, but it's incredibly difficult to keep something like this under wraps. What did you learn?
Well, it is incredibly difficult, but they'd succeeded in doing a similar thing before, because up until this point, before this happened, the worst nuclear accident in history had actually taken place inside the Soviet Union in 1957, near the city of Chelyabinsk in the Urals. And then there had been an explosion in a waste storage tank that was used to store an enormous amount of extremely toxic byproducts of the plutonium production process for use in atom bombs. And they'd managed to keep that completely secret, despite the fact that this had resulted in a huge release of radiation. But this was partly because it happened deep inside the interior of the Soviet Union, a long way from the European border, and also that the wind was blowing towards the east. So the trace of this material, of fallout that fell across the landscape, fell further inside the Soviet Union. But they managed to cover that up almost completely. And it wasn't until even after the fall of the Soviet Union that the truth about that accident emerged. So you can see that not only were Soviet officials, you know, long schooled in these traditions of reflexive secrecy, but they'd also had long experience in covering up nuclear accidents. So they may well have believed that they could somehow keep a lid on this cloud of radiation that was, you know, almost immediately escaping Soviet borders. Hmm.
Today we are speaking with journalist Adam Higginbotham about his new book, Midnight in Chernobyl, The Untold Story of the World's Greatest Nuclear Disaster. In the early morning on April 26, 1986, reactor number 4 of the Chernobyl Atomic Energy Station exploded during a technical test, triggering one of the 20th century's greatest disasters. As Adam reports, there was a lot of misinformation at that time because Western journalists were not allowed access to any information in Moscow, and so they did their best with rumors and hearsay. And Adam's book is a very lengthy account of what actually happened. It's based on 10 years of investigation, interviews with a number of people. He read a lot of documents. And coming up after the break, we will talk about the long-term health effects of this disaster. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. We'll be back after this.
And you are listening to Your Call on KALW. And just a reminder, this is the last day of our spring membership drive, and you can help us reach our goal. We have had so many of you going to klw.org to show your support, and we have only a few more hours left, Dan.
We do. We have fewer than 7 hours, just over six. Five and two. Yeah, just about yep. 7 hours, because we're going to wrap things up today with All Things Considered at 5 o'clock. We will be done with the fundraising campaign at that time. Whether we hit the goal or not, we are going to end the campaign. But we're confident, as Ken was saying earlier, earlier, we know we're going to achieve these goals because, frankly, you're going to achieve these goals. In fact, we have something to help incentivize you to call now. We know that your call is a hugely important program to so many of you. We have people that will make contributions, and their comment will simply be, Rose! Exclamation point. They love this program, and I know you do too. We have a challenge right now. $1,500 has been generously offered by Arlene Charlip, Erica Delacourt, and Una Stevens Hardy. They have offered $1,500 to encourage 15 callers to call in to support your call. You do that now when you could dial 800-525-9917, 800-525-9917, or make that contribution online at kalw.org. I do see that we have one that came in a few minutes ago that's going to count towards that challenge, so 14 more callers.
And as a thank you gift, we are going to send you Midnight in Chernobyl for a pledge of $120 to KLW. 1-800-525-9917 or klw.org. 1-800-525-9917. KLW.org. This is a book that you will not forget. And it's a must read. 1-800-525-9917. Thank you.
You can make that contribution either in a one-time gift of $120 or a $10 monthly gift. Now back to your call.
Thank you.
This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar, and today we are speaking with journalist Adam Higginbotham. He writes narrative nonfiction and features for a number of publications, including The New Yorker and The New York Times Magazine. His new book is Midnight in Chernobyl, the untold story of the world's greatest nuclear disaster. And Adam will be with us for about 10 more minutes, so if you have any questions for him about his reporting, if you'd like to talk about what you remember in the news about Chernobyl and the years since, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. I'm sure you get this question a lot, Adam, but Tim just wrote in that he was mesmerized and horrified by the first episode of the HBO series. It's a dramatization of what happened in Chernobyl. Tim says it seems utterly believable. It's a warning to all of us that regardless of country, we should be wary of nuclear operators claiming that, quote, everything is under control. So first off, have you seen the HBO series?
I have. Well, I've seen the first two episodes, like most other people, I think.
And what'd you think?
It's really good TV. I enjoyed the second episode a lot more than the first one, I think. But you know, as you say, it's a dramatization, so it's you know, a lot of the stuff is kind of exaggerated and moved around and invented for dramatic effect.
And is your book being turned into a film?
Well, that's an interesting question. The book was actually optioned. When it was initially sold to the publisher back in 2015. We agreed that because I wanted to make sure that any adaptation was completely accurate, they were sort of contractually obliged to wait until I produced a draft manuscript based on my reporting. While that process was going on, then HBO announced that they were making this TV show. Although technically, I think that the adaptation of my book is still alive. I don't expect to see it anytime soon.
Well, let's hope with all these new companies out there making so many films, let's hope someone picks it up. What about the second part of Tim's question, that this is really a warning to all of us that we should be wary of nuclear operators claiming that everything is under control?
I think I regret to say Tim is kind of right because. You know, one thing that becomes apparent when you start looking at the history of the nuclear industry around the world is that although, you know, in the case of Chernobyl, the Soviet patterns of secrecy and cover-up are very extreme, you know, that those patterns have a lot in common with the UK nuclear industry, the US nuclear industry. You know, those industries have not done a great job of sharing and being honest with the public about things that have gone wrong.
Let's talk about what happened to the people who lived in the vicinity of the explosion. We have just about 5 minutes left, but what really stands out for you when you interviewed people, just about how they were affected and where they are today?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, that's one of the other things that really drove me to want to write a book-length narrative about this, was that I began to realize the more I talked to people that, you know, their experience of living in Pripyat, the company town that was built to house the workers at the plant and their families, it was built very close to the reactor itself. You know, their experience before the accident was of living in this kind of wonderful place that was as close to the Soviet notion of a worker's paradise as really existed. It was a wonderful place to live. The majority of people who lived there were young families, and more than a third of the population were children. So rather than the version of the story that I was aware of as a reporter before I ever began talking to people, where it's just this kind of, you know, the grim prelude to grim events, and there's an explosion and there's a cover-up, and everything conforms to your sort of stereotypical views of the Soviet Union. In fact, you know, what happened to these people was not merely the terrible events of April the 26th and thereafter, but they had lost this kind of wonderful life. They were removed from this city, and they had to leave their lives behind overnight. Mm. And, you know, that experience made a real impact on me, and it is that I thought was one of the major points of the story that had never really been disclosed before.
How many people were evacuated from the area? Is it 350,000 people?
Well, 116,000 people were evacuated, I think, within the first 10 days, and then another 100,000 shortly after that. And then subsequently, this exclusion zone that was established around the plant has been gradually expanded. So to be honest, I'm not even sure what the total number of people who are evacuated is, but it must be up around there, if not more.
And so with this exclusion zone created around the plant, the severe restrictions on permanent human settlement are still in place today. This covers an area now in Ukraine and Belarus?
That's right. I mean, part of the problem with dealing with this kind of nuclear accident is that, you know, the pattern of distribution of fallout was randomized by meteorology and wind. So that there are, you know, large parts of the exclusion zone that are if not perfectly safe, then largely safe. But they're right next to places where there remain, you know, hotspots of extreme toxicity. And because it's invisible without the correct equipment, it was simpler in the first instance, and remains simpler today, to simply move everybody out of the area than to try and, you know, tell people where specific parts are safe and other parts are dangerous hotspots. So, you know, although there are parts of the exclusion zone that probably are habitable, it's safer to keep people out.
And then the health effects. A United Nations study group cooperating with the governments of Ukraine, Belarus, and Russia estimated that by 2005, about 4,000 people who were children at the time of the accident had developed thyroid cancer caused by iodine-131 from the reactor, leading to 9 deaths. Their estimates suggest that up to 5,000 fatal cancers might occur in the most heavily contaminated regions of the former Soviet Union as a result of the radiation released by the accident?
Yeah, that's right. Although those numbers have continued to increase. Mm-hmm. I think the total of diagnosed thyroid cancers has risen to about 7,000 now. But it's important to understand that a lot of those numbers are estimates because, you know, the complications of epidemiology and also the fact that the data was either concealed or deliberately lost by the Soviet government in the months and years after the accident happened. You know, we can only really estimate what the true health costs of what happened are.
Hmm. And Adam, what would you say are the lessons in this tragedy and in your book for today?
I think that, you know, the for me, the overwhelming lesson is of one of overconfidence in technology of any kind. You know, it was the the arrogance and hubris of the leaders of the Soviet nuclear industry that really paved the way towards this accident. You know, they successfully assured everybody that this model of reactor that was built in Chernobyl was one of the safest in the world. And they themselves, the leaders of the Ministry of Medium Machine Building, which was the agency responsible for the atom weapons program, and the Atomic Energy Ministry, you know, they had personal experience of radiation exposure, which had made them very reckless and cavalier about it. And I think those, you know, those cavalier attitudes carried through all the way down to individual plant workers, because although they knew the ins and outs of the technology they were working with, they didn't really think that an accident on this scale could ever happen. And you know, that was a severe problem, because it meant that when it actually did happen, many of them couldn't even believe that it did and continued in the state of denial even after they had evidence that they could see with their own eyes.
Well, Adam, thank you so much for your work, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Adam Higginbotham is a journalist whose narrative nonfiction has appeared in many publications, including the New York Times Magazine, and his new book is Midnight in Chernobyl, The Untold Story of the World's Greatest Nuclear Disaster. You can find out more about his work at yourcallradio.org. This is Your Call's Media Roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar. Now we are going to talk about media coverage of continued attacks on abortion rights. As you know, this week, Alabama Governor Kay Ivey signed the country's most extreme anti-abortion law, making abortions a felony, even in cases of rape and incest. And those who perform the procedure could face up to 99 years in prison. Services are still available in Alabama, although there are only 3 clinics in that state. That is the case in many states across the country. At the earliest, the measure could take effect in 6 months. Many organizations are planning to sue. And joining us is Jody Jacobson, president and editor-in-chief of Rewire.news, an online publication focused on health, rights, and justice. Hi, Jody. Welcome back to the show.
Hey, Rose. Thank you, as always, for having me.
Well, thank you, Jody. You know, I've been thinking so much about the media coverage of this, and thinking back to the last 14 years of hosting this show. Every year we do so many shows about attacks on abortion. I mean, this is nothing new. Yes, this one is very extreme, no exceptions for rape and incest. But as you and your team report on Rewired.news every single day, this is just the latest in ongoing attacks on abortion.
Yes, it is just the latest. It's been now a couple decades of this kind of thing increasingly being put forth at the state and local level, whether they be trap laws or method bans or other kinds of laws that seek to really eliminate access to abortion care and to, if you will, not just nibble around the edges of Roe, but to literally chomp it to death, so that you get to a point where Roe has been intact from the Supreme Court point of view, but the actual meaning and spirit of the law is gone, because you can't get access to abortion care. And so these laws are sort of next level attacks, in that they are increasingly focused not on, you know, later pregnancies, which the right loves to demonize, but rather even as early in Alabama's case as, you know, when your egg is fertilized, which is not a pregnancy, and you don't know when that happens. So it's basically criminalizing women for existing, any menstruating woman for existing.
Well, and this is just so extreme. I mean, it's kind of surreal to even say no exceptions for rape and incest, because during the Republican presidential debates, everyone running for president opposed abortion, and the exceptions for rape and incest were actually a debate. I remember Marco Rubio saying he did not support any exceptions, and then he had to walk that back. So, I mean, Jody, you've been reporting on this for a long time. Can you talk about the significance of no exceptions? Because Senator Singleton from Alabama was on CNN saying that last week he heard from a number of Republican men saying that their wives and their daughters said, you cannot vote for this. And then they came to work on Monday and they voted for it. He thinks Alec is behind the exception. And yesterday we had a senator on the show, one of four women who are in the Senate in Alabama, and she said definitely someone got to them because last week they were saying that they were not going to vote for this.
Right. Well, okay, so let's face it. Most all of these bills are coming from groups that heavily invest in these folks, you know, campaigns, whether it's Americans United for Life or other groups that are connected to and funded in part by ALEC-affiliated money. So yes, they are under heavy pressure from anti-choice groups to be voting for these things. I think, though, from my point of view, and obviously there's a debate about this, but from my point of view, we get ourselves caught up on the whole issue of exceptions because it's kind of grotesque, right? You say someone, a child, has been raped by their father or their uncle or what have you, their brother, and yet you are still forcing them to bear a pregnancy, and that is grotesque. But the problem with this exceptions conversation is that it wipes away every other need for abortion by saying, oh, without exceptions, but for the exceptions, it would be okay. That's the way it comes out. And so it's not okay in any form. They are obviously particularly grotesque because of the lack of these exceptions, but the exceptions don't make them okay. And also, I want to just make people understand that the exceptions are almost meaningless, even if they exist. Why? Well, for one thing, in most of these exceptions, you have to have lodged a police report. So let's think about this for a second. A 12-year-old is raped by her father. Is she going to the police? I don't think so, because probably if she's raped by her father, she's not free to go to the police on her own, and she's being abused and controlled by her father. So if she hasn't entered a police report, she's not getting an abortion. That's the first thing. The second thing is that who is going to be providing that abortion care? So when you eliminate abortion care from the vast majority of people, it becomes economically infeasible to provide abortion care.
Right.
So who's left to provide? Who's left to provide for the exception of the health of the mother, which is a, you know, like later in pregnancy is very specialized treatment. If you've got a pregnancy that endangers your life or that has turned into a pregnancy that is not viable, there are, you know, there are highly skilled procedures for these things. Who's going to be doing that? There's no one left. So I think that these exceptions are kind of like, you know, they're wrapping a bow around something very awful, and we are all attracted by the bow, but the bow doesn't really, isn't really very pretty to begin with.
Can you talk about the media's coverage of all of this and the historical context here? We don't have to go very far, but when you go back to 2010 and you look at the Republican wave taking over so many state legislatures across the country, and then you add to that, well, and that happened because of gerrymandering in many states, and then you add to that voter suppression. So in many districts across the country, there's just no way that a Democrat can even win. The Republicans have such a stranglehold on so many districts across the country. So once that happened, that's when we started seeing a wave of these laws. Are you hearing that context or seeing that context in much of the reporting around these laws?
I'm not seeing it at all in the reporting. I'm seeing it like I'm saying it all over the place myself, because I don't think any of these things, and you know, let's include abortion rights and many of the other very important and critical rates that we face that we are losing, none of this is going to be addressed unless we focus on voting rights and election security. In Georgia, Stacey Abrams would never have signed such a bill. And I do believe that because of voter suppression, I mean, the evidence is there, Stacey Abrams is not governor, not because she lost, but because she was cheated out of an election. So there is no question in my mind that going through a process of denying people their right to vote therefore allows people like the Brian Kemps of the world to then deny people their rights further in other areas that enforce white supremacy. So if you think about voter suppression as a form of, you know, of further embedding white supremacy, so is lack of abortion care, so are other things, and those come out of this lack of voting rights. I think the reporting hasn't been there on this at all, and I think it's really, really critical.
You just reminded me of a new film from Brave New Films called Suppressed, the True Story of Georgia's 2018 Election. And they report that during those elections in Georgia, millions of voters experienced suppression, ranging from voter purges to poll closures to lines over 4 hours. Strict ID laws disproportionately affect, actually block brown and black citizens from voting. So that is very connected to this story. The other thing I want to ask you about, Jody, and every time you're on, we talk about this. Data for Progress has some new numbers out, and it found that there is no state in the country where support for banning abortion reaches even 25%. So just to repeat that, no state in the country where support for banning abortion reaches even 25%. And even though that is the case, you still hear in the media, you name the outlet, they call this the most divisive issue of our time.
Right. Corporate media, generally speaking, is doing grave, grave injustice on this issue and many other issues, just grave injustice. And you have people with very large platforms. One of my favorite of these, not in the sense of really good favorite, but is Chris Matthews, who last night held a town hall in Pennsylvania, you know, around the 2020 election, and went on his own sort of diatribe about abortion, everything he said of which was absolutely in error. And so it's just astounding to me. You've got Morning Joe people like Willie Geist and others on who don't know how to talk about these bills from a fact-based perspective. The media is so misinformed, and they are so, you know, they're literally sort of pickled in anti-choice language, so they don't know how to describe these this legislation from an actual medical perspective, and they also buy the, you know, buy the very point you're making, which is that it's a divisive issue. It really isn't a divisive issue. But there you have it. We've got, you know, a media that I believe has been irresponsible in many ways, not least of which what happened in the 2016 election.
Right. Well, and then to add to that, we're talking about lives here because lives are at stake. We are already seeing people, if they can afford it, and there are funds that are being created and have already been in effect for years, of actually flying women and girls to other states. So for me, what's so hard about this is to hear hosts so calmly say, well, we'll see if the Supreme Court takes this case up. And I'm thinking, you know, there are lives at stake here. You do these hardcore analyses of what's going on in other countries where abortion is illegal and women are dying. Well, we need to do that here.
Absolutely. There's no question. I just want to, you know, give a shout out to the National Network of Abortion Funds, and any state that you are in almost certainly has an independent abortion fund, which is set up with donor funding, in other words, dollars from people who contribute, $5, $10, $15, whatever it is, to help people who can't afford to go from one state to the other, or, for example, go through all the hoops that are created by unnecessary waiting periods and so forth to get an abortion. So those funds are critical in making sure that people can exercise their rights. Then also I'd recommend, again, going back to what you said earlier, the fact about voting rights and that people contribute to voting rights groups across the country, because if we do not have a free and fair election in 2020, we are in deep trouble. Mm. And the only way we're going to have that free and fair election is if, in fact, people on the ground are enabled with money and support to work with communities to make sure they are able to vote. This is a long and in-depth project, and we all need to be investing in it. So, yeah, these are critical and connected problems.
Well, Jody, as always, thank you for connecting the dots with us, and thank you for your work, and we'll have you back soon.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Jody Bye. Jacobson is president and editor-in-chief of Rewire.news, an online publication focusing on health, rights, and justice. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your Calls Media Roundtable.